Rain Pryor's memoir isn't just another celebrity tell-all. It's a raw, unflinching exploration of growing up biracial in America with one of comedy's most brilliant and troubled minds as a father. The daughter of legendary comedian Richard Pryor and Jewish dancer Shelley Bonas, Rain's story offers a unique window into both Black and Jewish cultures while navigating the complexities of fame, addiction, and family dysfunction. The book has become required reading in many African American and Jewish studies programs, with Dave Chappelle calling it the most honest account of growing up in Richard Pryor's orbit. Beyond its cultural significance, this memoir resonates with anyone who's ever felt caught between two worlds, searching for identity while yearning for parental love that seems perpetually out of reach. My story begins with an unexpected union between two distinctly different individuals. My father, a successful entertainer who came from humble beginnings in Peoria, and my mother, a progressive-minded woman from Brooklyn with strong political convictions. Their initial meeting at a social gathering was marked by mutual antipathy, yet fate had other plans, leading to an impromptu wedding in Las Vegas. During a contemplative rainy afternoon, my father traced R-A-I-N on a misty windowpane, choosing my name before I existed. At age 4, my mother drove me through Los Angeles to meet my father for the first time at his Hollywood Hills estate. Upon arrival, we were greeted by Maxine, who introduced herself and mentioned her daughter Elizabeth. When she indicated my father, a lean figure animated in conversation amidst a group of people, I was struck by our unmistakable resemblance. We shared the same facial features, expressive dark eyes, and distinctive hands. Noticing me immediately, he paused mid-conversation and exclaimed with surprise and delight, addressing his companions proudly, "Look at that resemblance! This one's definitely mine." Though initially hesitant, I approached at his invitation. As he embraced me, offered a paternal kiss, and declared, "Little Rain Pryor, my perfect little princess," I felt overwhelming joy. I had found my father, and he was warm and welcoming. That first visit to my father's mansion was extraordinary for a child accustomed to modest living. The gathering included entertainment industry figures and various social circles. Richard initially showed great enthusiasm, though his attention eventually drifted. I met Elizabeth, who became my protective older sister, guiding me through the expansive house. I was also introduced to Richard Jr., my 10-year-old half-brother, and possibly another sibling named Renee. Most significantly, I met Mama, Richard's great-grandmother and his primary caregiver during his childhood in Peoria. When evening came, my mother announced I would stay overnight. Despite my anxious protests, she remained firm. "This is important family time, so be brave." Later that night, I encountered an adult situation that prompted a frank discussion with my father about mature relationships, handled with surprising directness and age-appropriate candor. My father had been married 6 times to 5 different women and had 7 children by the time I met him. Born in Peoria, Illinois, to a prostitute, he was raised by his grandmother, Mama, who owned several brothels. He grew up surrounded by whores who showered him with affection, especially his mother, whom he worshipped despite her being a temperamental drunk who often disappeared. After dropping out of high school and a brief stint in the Army, Richard began performing at comedy clubs with help from his former teacher, Juliette Whitaker. Following his first marriage to Patricia Price and the birth of his son, Richard Jr., he left Peoria in 1963 for the Chitlin Circuit before moving to Greenwich Village. Initially performing safe, Bill Cosby-style comedy that avoided race and politics, he became known as the Token Negro while appearing on various TV shows. By 1967, the tumultuous summer of love, Richard was growing tired of his inoffensive routines. During a breakthrough moment at the Aladdin Hotel in Las Vegas, he walked off stage after asking, "What the fuck am I doing here?" His epiphany that he needed to stop doing white bread comedy. This transformation would eventually make him the most influential comedian of his generation, but it came with personal costs that would reverberate through our family for decades. Shortly after this epiphany, he met my mother, Shelley Bonas, at a bar. A dancer under contract to Columbia Pictures, she caught his eye while dancing alone in her miniskirt and white leather boots. Their first conversation was electric. She called out his silly outfit. He challenged her talking black despite being white. Mom considered herself an African-American princess trapped in a Jewish girl's body from Brooklyn, wearing Afro wigs and talking jive. Within days, she moved into his Laurel Canyon home. Her parents, Herb and Bunny, liberal entertainment industry Jews who managed Danny Kaye's career, initially freaked out about their daughter dating a black man. "People are going to talk," Bunny warned. Despite their reluctance, Richard won them over somewhat, and the couple eloped to Vegas. For a few blissful weeks, they made love constantly and collected pet rocks they'd talk to. But Richard quickly incorporated their marriage into his comedy routine, joking he'd agreed to marry her during sex. While Mom viewed their relationship romantically, Dad saw sex as purely recreational. Their political discussions helped shape Richard's evolving consciousness, with Mom introducing him to Malcolm X, Angela Davis, and Black Panther writings. But their happiness wouldn't last.
When Shelley discovered she was pregnant, she hoped it might save their unraveling marriage. Meanwhile, Richard returned from a road trip sporting a red silk shirt, gold chains, high-heeled boots, and a glazed look, clear signs he was both cheating and using drugs. He'd disappear into the bathroom and emerge proclaiming, "I am super nigger. I am the coolest, funniest nigger the world has ever seen." When Shelley found and flushed his cocaine, Richard beat her severely, punching her pregnant stomach. Despite this violence, she couldn't bring herself to leave, partly to avoid her parents' "we told you so." Instead, she proposed they use her parents' $30,000 wedding gift to fund Richard's screenplay, Uncle Tom's Fairy Tales, about a white man tried by an all-black jury for raping a black woman. On July 16, 1969, as Apollo 11 headed toward the moon, I was born at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. My birth represented hope to my mother, a biracial child symbolizing America's bright future in the summer of love. Dad initially seemed thrilled, noticing my Mongolian spot birthmark and declaring I was something special. But when it was time to take me home, he didn't show up. Mom found him in bed with the housekeeper. Our biracial family never recovered from its rocky start. Mom inexplicably forgave Dad for his infidelity, though he never apologized. Richard had no interest in parenting, preferring to return when I was fun rather than deal with a crying infant. He spent nights with other women, even bringing them home. Despite the physical and emotional abuse, Mom desperately tried to save her marriage, blaming herself and becoming his number one fan again. After Richard left for good, Mom fled to New York, leaving me with my grandparents, Herb and Bunny. Her family urged her to give me up for adoption, claiming my grandparents lacked energy to raise a biracial child. After months of confusion and back and forth, Mom took me to New York, then returned me to Los Angeles, then took me back again. For my first 2 years, Bunny and Herb were essentially my parents. Mom struggled in New York, battling depression and occasionally turning to prescription painkillers. She worked as a dancer, while Miles Davis often babysat me, playing trumpet lullabies until I fell asleep. By 1972, Mom surrendered and returned to Los Angeles with just one suitcase and me. Her father's response, "We told you not to marry that man," offered little comfort. Life with Mom was tumultuous. I'd hide in my room during Grandpa Herb's rages, surrounding myself with stuffed animals for protection. Mom faced constant prejudice. Whites gave withering looks, while blacks were more vocal, one woman yelling, "You're the reason our men ain't home." Even border guards humiliated us, refusing to let me cross from Mexico without a birth certificate because I was obviously not hers. The stress turned Mom volatile. She'd pull my hair in frustration, then apologize, confessing she was miserable. By 4, I'd become a defiant smartass, deliberately misbehaving to provoke her anger, because the reconciliations afterward were the only times I felt truly loved. After meeting my father, my life changed dramatically. I became a regular visitor at Richard's home, developing relationships with my half-siblings and Mama. I also spent more time with my Jewish grandparents in Sherman Oaks, where I absorbed their culture, language, and cooking. Bunny made traditional Jewish dishes, while Herb told showbiz stories. Despite their constant arguing, they provided stability I hadn't known before, calling me Rainflower and teaching me the rhythms of Jewish life. They embraced my mixed ethnicity, making me feel special as a Black Jewish American princess. By kindergarten, I felt almost normal with divorced parents like many classmates, though my Black and Jewish identity still made me unique. I became adaptable, changing to suit any situation, a skill that later helped my acting career but left me unsure of my identity. Dad's Parthenia Street house became my second home, with its citrus orchards, boxing ring, and pool where we played games inspired by Twilight Zone, diving underwater to escape to a world where families stayed together. The house was always filled with people, celebrities, hangers-on, and a parade of hookers that I accepted as normal. Life there was pleasant at first, but Dad's erratic behavior, likely drug-induced, meant he could explode for no reason, beating us until exhausted, then becoming sweet an hour later. Only Mama could keep him somewhat controlled during her visits from Illinois, when she'd run the house like clockwork and turn a blind eye to his drug use. During my early years, I bounced between three different households: Mom's apartment, Dad's place, and my grandparents' apartment in Marina Del Rey. With a famous entertainer father, a talent agent grandfather, and a mother aspiring to be an entertainer, it was natural that I too would be drawn to performing. When I was 9, Mom introduced me to the circus through her work as a photographer for Ringling Bros. I became fascinated with clowns, how a normal person could transform completely with face paint, a red nose, and floppy shoes. This idea of becoming someone else entirely appealed deeply to me. Mom's connections meant I always rode in the circus parade and got picked from the audience. One clown, Skeeter, a Black man who briefly became my mother's boyfriend, taught me card games, board games, and magic tricks. When I drew his picture at school, my teacher insisted there's no such thing as a Black clown, refusing to believe me. My circus fascination continued into my preteen years. The clowns taught me magic tricks, basic acrobatics, and juggling. Mom excitedly announced we would join the circus together, but Dad shut down the plan immediately. "No daughter of mine is going on the road with no motherfucking circus." Instead, he compensated by taking his three eldest children to exotic locations like London, Paris, Hawaii, and Jamaica. Our Paris trip was especially memorable, flying on the Concorde, staying at the elegant George V Hotel, and being amazed by dogs in fine restaurants and young children speaking French. During our travels, Dad would quiz each child about their favorite comedian. While my siblings dutifully answered, "You, Daddy," I enthusiastically proclaimed, "Steve Martin." Though Dad laughed, I could tell he was annoyed, muttering, "Fuck Steve Martin." Dad seemed to enjoy watching us kids evolve as we got older. Our fishing trips felt like normal family time. He'd teach us about bobbers, baiting hooks, and casting. Whenever we caught even tiny fish, he'd jump around excitedly like we'd caught a motherfucking shark. These domestic moments were rare because he wasn't a regular father. He was consumed by his up-and-down career. When a redheaded kid called me a nigger and pushed me down at school, I bit him and called him a motherfucker. Though I got in trouble, my mother stormed into the principal's office demanding the little hunky kid apologize to me. Later, Mama gave me a lesson about racial identity using her tarot cards as a starting point. She explained that in our house, nigga was a term of endearment, but when used by white people, it carried harmful power. "You Black, Rainy," she told me. "The world's gonna see Rain as a nigga no matter what her mother is." In early 1979, at 10 years old, I finally saw my father perform live in Long Beach, California. Watching from behind the curtain, I witnessed his commanding stage presence and understood for the first time what he truly did for a living. I realized my daddy didn't just tell jokes. He told funny stories that explored deeper truths. Comedy was hard. After my father's performance, Mama came to visit, looking noticeably older and more tired. Daddy took us to Jamaica, with Elizabeth, Deborah, and others joining. We stayed in a beautiful house near Kingston with a chef and housekeeper. We toured Rose Hill Plantation, hearing slavery stories that deeply affected me. By the third day, Dad's mood darkened inexplicably, possibly withdrawal, and he began picking fights with everyone. During dinner one night in Jamaica, Dad violently slapped me when I called a servant Dota, drawing blood from my nose. When I explained the servant had asked me to use her nickname and she confirmed this, Dad only became more enraged and paranoid, claiming everyone was out to get him. By morning, he'd forgotten the incident entirely. In 1979, Mama died, devastating my father. She had been his rock and the one person he truly trusted. At her funeral in Peoria, Dad sat weeping uncontrollably until he eventually collapsed and had to be carried out. Flying back to Los Angeles, he confided to Elizabeth and me, "I can't go on. I just don't see how I can go on. Nothing means shit no more." On June 1, 1980, at the peak of his fame, my father poured rum over himself and struck a match. Though initially reported as a freebasing accident, he later confessed to me it was a suicide attempt. Devastated by Mama's death and increasingly dependent on cocaine, Dad had locked himself in his bedroom during a party. According to what he later told me, he was hallucinating conversations with both Mama and his character Mudbone. While Mama urged him to live, Mudbone encouraged him to end it all. I learned about Dad's hospitalization the next morning when my grandparents and I heard it on the radio while driving to school. Despite my desperate pleas to see my father, my grandparents insisted I attend school as usual, dropping me off with just a chin up and hang in there. Standing alone on the sidewalk with my school books and lunchbox, I felt completely abandoned, only to be greeted with a cruel taunt, "Your dad is a burnt piece of shit." I immediately attacked the boy who said it, ending up in the principal's office being scolded rather than receiving any sympathy. When I finally saw him weeks later, he first joked that he mixed two kinds of milk that exploded, but eventually admitted the truth. I was drunk out of my motherfucking mind, stoned too, and I was feeling sorry for myself, and I wanted to die, so I set my black ass on fire. Despite his flaws, his misogyny, violence, and narcissism, I loved him desperately, believing that if I loved him enough, he'd never want to die again. When Mom and I returned from Tahiti, Dad unexpectedly offered to buy us a house. We found a place in Studio City with a big yard, but the deal collapsed when Dad insisted on putting the house in my name, not Mom's, saying, "I don't want her getting it." Mom was devastated, believing I'd eventually kick her out. As I prepared for Beverly Hills High, Mom warned me about the bitch shit I'd face there. She was right. The Jewish girls rejected me, questioning my hair and my identity. When I tried connecting with the black girls, they weren't impressed either. "You so bright, I need sunglasses just to look at you." I cycled through various styles trying to fit in before giving up and focusing on finding a boyfriend. My Sweet 16 party at the Delray Yacht Club was one of my best high school memories. Mom was relatively together by then, and my grandparents helped organize it. Dad attended and was moved to tears when I sang a song I'd written for him. Everyone signed a guestbook with heartfelt messages, including Mom, who wrote that I had the magic and the music. It was a rare, perfect day that showed me how much my mother truly loved me. That summer at Idlewood Performing Camp, I was cast as Anita in West Side Story, which cemented my determination to become an actor. Junior year, I played Tiger Lily in an elaborate Beverly Hills High production of Peter Pan. Dad attended and praised me repeatedly. "Good work, baby. You obviously got the stuff." By senior year, I was failing academically while pouring my heart into acting. I started hanging with the badass black girls, drinking fortified wine with gangbangers. We entered dance competitions at Venice Pier and hit clubs on weekends. After another terrible argument with Mom, I swallowed half a bottle of Tylenol and called my boyfriend, dramatically announcing, "It's all over." The unimpressed doctors sent me home to sleep it off. The next day, Dad called me over and surprised me with a brand new Nissan, never mentioning my suicide attempt. Mom went ballistic, screaming at Dad that I needed help, not a car. Dad couldn't understand. Gifts and money were his way of solving problems. In 1986, my senior year, Dad married Flynn Belaine, whom he'd met on a movie set. Once again, I learned about Dad's wedding from the newspaper. He hurt me deeply in an interview, saying he wasn't crazy about the way his kids were turning out. I wrote him a heartbreaking letter I never mailed, telling him, I could care less about your money. All I ever asked for was your time and love.
Richard Pryor's ex-wives and ex-girlfriends formed a strange kind of fan club, often vacationing together with their children and sharing war stories. In 1986, my final year of high school, Dad began experiencing headaches after sex. Doctors discovered scarring in his brain and diagnosed him with multiple sclerosis. None of us understood how serious it was. Dad seemed perfectly healthy otherwise. He asked us not to tell anyone, knowing Hollywood would stop hiring him if they knew about his degenerative disease. I was eager to launch my acting career and attended countless auditions. At one, I met casting director Ronnie Yeskel, who introduced me to theatrical agent Josh Shiowitz. He got me an audition for Head of the Class, where I performed as Juanita, a pseudo-gangbanger character I'd created. The producers loved it and offered me a recurring role as TJ Jones. On my first day of shooting, I received a standing ovation from the studio audience. Dad visited the set once, causing a sensation, and afterward told me, "You were good, baby. You were real good. Definitely got the stuff." My small success quickly went to my head. With money in my pocket, I felt invincible and made stupid choices, drinking, drugs, and acting tougher than I was. I even got breast implants at a boyfriend's urging, though he didn't stick around to enjoy them. I tried being responsible by buying a house in Toluca Lake, expecting Dad to help with the $100,000 down payment. When he only gave me $10,000, I struggled with the mortgage. After Head of the Class ended, I lost everything, including my foolishly purchased Porsche. Constant rejection destroyed my self-esteem, and I developed a fear of auditioning. Every casting director had a different reason I wasn't right. Not black enough, not Jewish enough, not tall enough, not short enough. At 23, I was nearly unemployable, but still refused to consider a real job, afraid my acting dream would die. That's an actor's life, gambling that one success will lead to another, but often finding yourself still waiting tables years later, clinging to a dream that keeps you going each morning. Dad's MS was progressing rapidly. After losing feeling in his leg while driving, his condition deteriorated quickly. Following his second heart attack and triple bypass surgery, he hired a personal trainer and filled the house with exercise equipment, but only partially cut back on cigarettes and alcohol. In 1992, Dad went to Sierra Tucson Rehabilitation Center, where he emotionally apologized for his failures as a father. "I'm sorry I hit you when you were little. Sorry I did drugs in front of you. Sorry about the hookers." He gave me a teddy bear, a gift to the neglected child in me. While Dad deteriorated, I was struggling to find myself. My upbringing had left me without a center. Jewish traditions from Herb and Bunny, Mom's New Age beliefs, and Dad's ever-changing religious affiliations. I became a chameleon, changing myself to please others. I tried 12-step meetings, not because I had serious substance issues, but because I was lost. There, I learned to listen to myself and discovered the real me had value. In 1995, Dad and I finally acted together on Chicago Hope. He played an MS patient and I played his daughter. I didn't have to fake my tears watching him struggle. He was nominated for an Emmy but didn't win. His condition continued deteriorating. He drank martinis with Thicket when he could barely swallow, his legs shook violently when he tried to stand, and his voice became barely audible. After working at a psychic hotline and struggling with acting, I trained as a drug counselor at a Jewish rehab center, finding new purpose in helping others. There, I met Kevin, tall, olive-skinned, and well-dressed. After learning he wasn't gay, as I'd initially assumed, we went on our first date, and I remember nothing except that toe-curling goodnight kiss. 3 months later, I introduced him to my mother, who was immediately impressed. During a weekend getaway to Montecito, Kevin proposed on the beach at sunset with a diamond ring, and I tearfully accepted. We had a small half-Jewish, half-Catholic ceremony. I'd wanted my father to walk me down the aisle, but he preferred sitting quietly, not wanting to take attention from me or display his illness. Instead, my grandfather Herb and family friend Melvin Van Peebles did the honors, though I kept looking at my father throughout the ceremony.
Kevin encouraged me to pursue my dreams, supporting me while I created my solo show, Fried Chicken and Latkes, which explored my mixed Jewish and Black identity. As Dad's health declined, my relationship with his wife Jennifer worsened. I found him looking haunted and afraid during visits, but he refused to leave his home. Soon, I received unsigned letters telling me to stay away, and discovered Jennifer had written hateful things about me and my siblings on Dad's website, claiming she was the only one who truly loved him. Following advice from my husband Kevin and director Melvin Van Peebles, if Hollywood doesn't give you a career, create your own, I developed a one-woman show featuring characters like Juanita and Mama. After initial setbacks, Kevin and I produced Fried Chicken and Latkes ourselves, playing to sold-out crowds. The show received glowing reviews and led to national performance offers. On December 10, 2005, while visiting friends in Baltimore, I received the call I'd been dreading. My father had suffered a heart attack and passed away. The newspapers overflowed with tributes, from the New York Times calling him an iconoclastic comedian who transcended barriers, to praise from fellow artists. Neil Simon called him the most brilliant comic in America. Eddie Murphy said he was better than anyone who ever picked up a microphone. And Whoopi Goldberg declared there will never be another Richard Pryor. But beyond the accolades, he was first and foremost my father, whom I miss every day, while knowing he's up there flirting with angels. Through all the pain, abuse, and neglect, I somehow managed to find my own voice, one that honors both sides of my heritage while carving out a unique identity as Rain Pryor, not just Richard's daughter. In the end, perhaps that's the greatest legacy he could have left me. The courage to tell my own story, in my own way, with all its messy, complicated, and beautiful truth.